Thank you, Brother Malcolm. Good evening, everyone. John, I'm wondering if you might just dim some of the lights for us to help. So tonight, and God willing next week, we have opportunity to give some consideration to... To give some consideration to this interesting, rather, some might say, peculiar little gem within the Old Testament, this book of Esther. I think arguably, some might say that if this book didn't exist, it really wouldn't change in any significant fashion the doctrines that we have, our understanding as believers. And on the surface, while it seems to be a great content story, it doesn't necessarily have a great deal to do with modern day, we might say, with modern day life and living. But we hope over the course of the next couple of weeks to find a few overlaps with our own circumstances and a few aspects that demonstrate through the reading of God's word that his purpose is always been constant right from the beginning, that he is always working towards the fulfillment of his purpose, and that you and I, just as with Abraham, as with Joseph, and as with Esther, are part of this purpose. And so we put up this outline to give you a sense of where we plan on spending our time. This first class will focus on what we would maybe call the periphery aspects of the book, not looking directly and in-depth into its content, but more on an overview and background, those kinds of things. So we want to try and think about what the key message of the book is. We'll try and navigate the unclear period in history in which the events of the book took place. And with the difficulty in dating the book, it becomes difficult to specify exactly which Ahasuerus was the Persian king at the time. But we wanted just to wade into this, knowing full well my audience, hoping to learn more from you after class if I wade in over my head. So then we will consider what we know of Esther herself, and we'll begin an overview of this book named after her. And I also would like to draw a parallel from her story into the story of Joseph. And we may have time to get into that tonight. If not, we will cover that first thing next class. Because there's a number, and I've only scratched the surface in as we go through the two stories and to see the similarities that are there. And this was just enough to get maybe our thinking juices flowing, shall we say. And then that will bring us to a conclusion for this week. By next week, we plan, God willing, on getting more into some of the subject matter directly and the content of the book itself. So with that in mind, let's take a look at the key message. Now, the first thing written about a book of Esther in most commentaries that you'll go to, it focuses on the fact that the book itself makes no mention of God or of his name in the entire book. There are also no direct references to the law of Moses, to the temple, or to Jewish worship itself. There are also no New Testament writers that quote this book. In fact, some writers get so distressed about this point that they've made all kinds of attempts to try and resolve it and to make this book legitimate in their eyes. And we found that they have searched the original text and they've discovered the Yahweh tetragram in the book. Apparently, and I haven't confirmed this, but in the original, in Esther chapter 5, verse 4, the initial letters of four consecutive words, you can spell Yahweh. So that's the extent, though. You can see that some people will take, in some instances, to justify a book like this. And Martin Luther himself was a strong voice in his day against this particular book. In fact, he was so hostile to the book of Esther that he wrote, "I would that it did not exist, for it Judaizes too much and has in it a great deal of heathenous naughtiness." And it's interesting that Martin Luther makes the point that it Judaizes too much. And I think we, in our understanding of God's purpose with his people, we wouldn't obviously make that comment, would we? In fact, that is, I think, one of the special reasons that we can take from the book is the importance that God put on those promises that he made way back to Abraham to show the extent to which God is prepared to work with a people, a nation that even at times isn't seeking to work with him. And he's actively working towards the accomplishment of his initial plan and purpose. Now, as we read this book, we come to realize that God has acted in this piece of history to accomplish his purpose. The main conclusion that we come to after studying it is that despite the absence of his name anywhere in the book, that God is, and that God does, and therefore God will continue to act through history to accomplish his purpose, regardless of whether the peoples of that particular age acknowledge him or not. So while we might say that God is hidden in the story, we must also say that his presence is evident beyond measure. And we note that he is using both children of promise and those outside of his covenant as tools to accomplish this purpose. Now, as we explore this book, we want to be conscious of a number of issues that we pick up on here that apply to the events in Esther, but in fact, they also apply to us today. And we must all say amen to these points, I think, as a backdrop to our own circumstances and to our own understanding of how God works in our lives today. And the first point we'd like to take from this book is that even though God's people don't acknowledge him, we see that his presence is always at work. So just as it were in Esther's time, so then it must be also for us today. Secondly, his promises never fail. We talked about this back in Genesis 12, when God told Abraham that he would bless those who bless thee and curse those who curse thee. We see these things coming to pass time and time again. And God not only rules over the major issues in life, but also in the trivialities of life to accomplish his purpose. We often say that Esther is a book demonstrating the providence of God. But what do we mean by that exactly? It's not like we have significant usage of that word itself in Scripture. In fact, the expression is used only once in both the Authorized Version and also in the NIV. So, in the Authorized Version, Acts 24 is the passage. If you just open there briefly, just as we consider this word providence. Acts 24, we read from verse 2. So in Acts 24, actually we'll start back in verse 1 for some context. It tells us that after 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, descended with the elders and with a certain orator named Tertullius, who informed the governor against Paul. And when he was called forth, Tertullius began to accuse him, saying, "Seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness." We see that word providence in the original is a word that means foresight or to make provision for. But when we look at the context there in Acts, It's really talking about the foresight of a worldly ruler. Proverbs 27:1 says, "Boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day may bring forth." So by implication, man doesn't have the foresight that God does. Thou knowest not what a day may bring forth, but God does know. Let's just turn to the NIV usage of the word providence, because it's a little better, more relevant to God. It's in Job chapter 10, verse 12. In the NIV, it says, "You gave me life and showed me kindness, and in your providence watched over my spirit." And so we have the definition of the word providence as meaning foresight. And we want to just now consider for a moment this concept and make sure that our understanding of the word and how we use it is consistent. Because I think it's true that we as brothers and sisters have a tendency to see God's hand in the special blessings of our life. But I think it's also fair to suggest that's less so of our trials. Though we sometimes feel, and I've heard it said, that other people's trials are meant to be by God. And I say this because I think it's important for us to see God's hand both in our blessings and in our trials, in our joy and also in our pain and our suffering, even in our own decisions. We must realize that God's loving hand operates in everything that happens to us and in everything that we do. Ephesians 1:11 speaks about God who works all things according to the counsel of his will. And we know that all things is an accumulation of good, bad, or indifferent. They all work together according to the counsel of his will. And Paul tells us in 1 Thessalonians to be thankful in everything. So we know that we should be thankful for God's mercy in the midst of trouble, but it's harder for us to see God's hand, I think, and in our own sinful or in our own unwise decisions. But we must consider, however, that God's hand of providence must be in these decisions also. We have just been going through the readings a while back. Brother Stephen was exhorting it to us on the story of Joseph and the fact that he continued to make right decisions and wrong things kept happening to him. Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery, yet he did nothing worthy of such treatment. He was sent to jail for doing the right thing. And yet, despite these things, Joseph eventually recognized that God's provident hand was working out things for good. Because we remember what he came to say to his brothers in Genesis 45, "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." And then later he said, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." Joseph's brothers made a sinful decision, but that sinful decision was part of God's providence to keep the family of Jacob alive. And thus, the passage is always true that says, all things work together for good, for those who love God, for those who are called according to his purpose. In this book of Esther, it shows us much about God's foresight. It shows us that God's foresight transcends time. Actions take place well in advance of the ultimate purpose for which they were designed. Much like Joseph, who waited over 13 years and he endured much hardship before he was able to understand his boyhood dreams and to see the high calling for which God had in mind for him, so too do we see this taking place in Esther. God's foresight also transcends nationality. He didn't only work through the Israelite, but both the Jew and through both Jew and Gentile. Within that group, even though his chosen people were not acknowledging his presence, he continued to acknowledge theirs. His control over the events becomes especially clear at the end of the book. Events had turned around completely from the way they were at the beginning. Instead of being in peril, the Jews were now at peace. And God, in the process, uses what we might consider a number of otherwise trivial events to accomplish that purpose. For example, the king's decision to summon Vashti after he was merry with a strong drink. Then Vashti's related refusal. The king's insomnia. And then the related passage that was read to him. No person or no detail of life escapes God. The all things work together for good includes all individuals and all events. We also take from this is that God proceeds on the basis of perfect knowledge. Intimate, accurate, and absolute knowledge. Psalm 11, verse 4 says, "The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord is on his heavenly throne. He observes the Son of Man. His eyes examine them." God's righteousness does not deviate from its original purpose, to manifest a people for his name, to bring glory to him. The irony for us, however, is that God's providence works in harmony with our freedom, our free will. It doesn't force people. The king made his own decisions. God did not compel him to act as he did. Haman plotted his own intrigues. He made his own arrangements. He built his own gallows. The same was true of Mordecai and Esther. Yet the sphere in which they made their decisions was God's. And in this way, Haman built his gallows, but God had him hanged on them. Another principle of God's providence is that it will culminate in the achievement of God's overall purpose. God has given us a genuine freedom, and yet he utilizes our freedom to cause things to turn out the way he wants them to. In this way, he causes our freedom to contribute to his divine purpose. We cannot comprehend this truth, but we can acknowledge that it is so. And to those of us with such a recognition comes great confidence and courage. However, to those who do not comes panic and punishment. And we see that in the characters of Esther and Mordecai, and then in Haman. So trying to date the writing of this book, so when this book was penned, is an interesting challenge, I understood as I was doing the study. And I've managed to find dates anywhere from 460 to 331 suggested as the dates of writing. Now that this, what I've got up here is suggesting the date that the events took place. The suggested dates of writing the book are somewhere between 460 and 331 BC. But I believe I'm safe in stating that the most general suggestions in what I've read was the dating for these events that we'll be covering in Esther occur in the range of about 508 to 473 BC. And we're given a few points of reference in this book, aren't we? We read one of them this evening. And let's just open up to Esther chapter 1 to help us to try and date this book. Esther 1, verses 1 to 4, tells us it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This is Ahasuerus which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persian Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. So here we're giving a few points of reference. Because it tells us, and depending on the version that you're reading from, you'll find either the name Ahasuerus or Xerxes in the NIV. We know that word that was translated, Ahasuerus or Xerxes, is a word that was translated from a Greek word, which simply reflected a title that was used for a number of Persian kings. We also know there wasn't an endless number of kings with that particular title. So we can start to sort of focus down our timing. But there was enough of them that the period in history would be in the range of about 100 years. And the title itself simply means mighty or venerable king. Now, we note some of the key milestones here being mentioned. It says it was the particular Ahasuerus who ruled the 127 provinces all the way from India to Kush. Okay, so that's the one point of reference. And it also tells us in verse 2 that the reign of this king was from the city of Shushan or Susa, depending on your version or your nationality. So we thought we'd put up a map of what the Persian Empire was meant to cover at its peak. I think the colors distinguish themselves well enough. The dull color in the middle there is the Persian Empire. It's sometimes referred to in historical literature as the Achaemenid dynasty. Now, at the height of their power around 500 BC, the Achaemenid rulers of Persia ruled over territories that roughly encompassed what we call today as Iran, Iraq, Armenia, Afghanistan, Turkey, Bulgaria, a small part of Greece, Egypt and Syria, northern India and Pakistan, Jordan, Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, Caucasia, Central Asia, Arabia, and Libya. So this map gives us an indication of the areas occupied under the reign of both Darius the First or Darius the Great, and for a portion of his son, Xerxes. But as it appears, it was about the 12th year of Xerxes' reign that many of the islands along the Aegean Sea were lost to his empire. And in this map, about dead center, we find the city of Susa, or Shushan, as we read it in the authorized version, as mentioned in verse 2. And that's where one of the king's palaces was. In fact, Darius was originally, I believe, from Persepolis. He also built palaces in Susa, and then north of that in Ecbatana. So there are palaces in each of those major areas. And I think the one in Susa is fairly central to his kingdom. So that was a good one for him to spend time in. So with this map in mind, I want to just spend a moment considering again which king it was that might be being spoken about here. And this seems to be another one of the big questions that many a historian and Bible student like to debate. Who was the king that Esther was married to? Well, from what I read, most claim it to be Xerxes, Darius' son. A number suggests it was Darius the Great, whose reign was from about 521 to 485 or 486. And he was born in 549 in brackets there. That's why I have that. The word Darius is another title rather than a name, and it means he who holds firm the good. So apart from these two mainstream suggestions, I have even read authors suggesting it was Darius's father, whose name was Hystaspes, or his grandson, Artaxerxes. So let's just take a look at some of the individual details that we know about these two kings. For Darius, there are certain historical facts that we know of. For example, we know that the empire reached its greatest extent under his reign. to the point of conquering part of India in 508, and that he ruled unto the isles of the sea. And that phrase, under the isles of the sea, is a phrase that's taken out of Esther chapter 10, verse 1. Darius was also known for dividing his empire into satrapies, or provinces, that were supervised by satraps. He commissioned an extensive road network through his empire, and he had one of the most advanced postal systems that there was at the time. And as we remember, some of the postal distributions that were made first by Haman and then later on by Mordecai, it seemed that there was some pretty swift mail delivery. And he also continued the practice of religious tolerance. That's one of the things that Darius was known for, which I think links nicely to a king that allowing the Jews to the rebuilding of the temple. Darius' son Xerxes, however, is a little more difficult to sketch his life together. His fascination, which was a carryover from his father's attempts at taking Greece, so he continued with his fascination to try and take Greece. And there's historical records indicating that he held a planning session for one of those battles in about 481 BC. Now, Xerxes wasn't as likely to allow tribes and nations within his empire to continue their customs. And he was known at times to impose his will on some of these uncooperative nations within his control. But beyond that, however, there doesn't seem to be many other details about some of the key events in Xerxes' reign, except for those of a military purpose. So, here we go. Let's wade a little further into this. We're going to, despite common historian suggestions, it makes the most sense based on the reading that I've done so far that it was Darius who was the king that was married to Esther. And also in Brother John Knowles' book on Esther, he seems to indicate this as well. For some of the reasons we had on the previous page and for the reasons that we have here, what we know about the reign of Darius seems much more consistent with what we know as some of the events that are outlined in the book of Esther, such as those events surrounding rebuilding of the temple and punishment of those against it, and even to the payment of those working on rebuilding. Now, something of interest, I'm not sure how clear you can see that. It's quite small, but it's just to give you a sense, the little smoother piece on that mountain in the middle there, it's what's referred to as the Behistuan inscription. And this picture here, just it kind of gives you a sense of where this inscription is located on a mountain and where it was carved and the probable difficulty that most people would have in reaching such an inscription after it was done, particularly in ancient times. Now that's a bit more of a close-up in that picture of the inscription itself. And it's a close-up of a carving, and surrounding the carving are some texts which captured the words of Darius the Great. And these words actually tell much about his conquests, and it was, I think this find was quite a breakthrough to historians. An interesting observation was made about this. As you can see how high it was up, and as they believed that there was a ledge that the sculptors were using to sculpt this. And once they finished their work, that they took this ledge away so that no one else could access it. And that's one of the reasons, in all likelihood, that this kind of structure is still there today. Although I understand in World War II, some of the soldiers were using it as target practice and the heads of some of these things were shot off. But anyways, for the most part, it's still there. So if you look at Esther, chapter 2 and verses 5 and 6, just another point of reference and possible support to which king we have, it tells us in verse 5, there was a certain Jew in Shushan the palace whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jer, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives that had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So that particular passage may or may not help us decide which king it was, but let's just explore the passage a little bit. So we know that the exile to Babylon took place around the year 597 BC. It's a fixed point in time for us. Now, if Mordecai, who it tells us was carried away in that passage with the other captives, if he was a young boy during that time, then by the time of Darius's reign, he would likely be in his 50s. And by the time Xerxes took over power, he would have been over 100 years old. So if this passage can be taken at face value, Esther would have been in her 80s when Xerxes was king, if we assume about a 20-year difference between Mordecai and her. So again, this would tend to be another indication that Darius must have been the king. But as you can imagine, there's much more to say on that particular subject, but the emphasis of our study wasn't necessarily to nail down exactly which king it was. So let's take a look at Esther and what we know about her and about her situation. And we just read from chapters 2, verses 5 and 6, but in verse 7, it tells us a little more. It says, "And he," being Mordecai, "he brought up Esther," "he brought up Hadassah," that is Esther, "his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maiden was fair and beautiful. And when her father and mother were dead, Mordecai took her for his own daughter." So we read here that Esther became an orphan at a young age and was either formally or informally adopted by her cousin Mordecai. Now, during the time of Esther, many Jews had returned from exile to Israel to establish the institutions under the law. But there were, however, a significant number who chose, for various reasons, to remain in the foreign lands to which they'd become, to which they were pulled into. And obviously Mordecai was one such of the Jewish people who chose to live in Susa. And as an aside, this fact brings some interesting thoughts to mind. Why wouldn't any devout Jew return to the land promised to their forefathers? History tells us that King Nebuchadnezzar only removed from the particular areas he captured, he only removed the most prominent citizens. And so he took the most of the prominent Israelites, the professionals, the priests, the craftsmen, and those with great wealth. He left the so-called people of the land behind, those who lived off of agriculture and so on. They stayed behind. And so with this polarization of peoples, their talents, as they were sort of superimposed on this new society, their talents would have been in demand in all likelihood within the rest of that world for their expertise, and that would have been possibly a draw for them to remain where they were and forgetting where they were meant to be and in whom they were to trust. And Mordecai was among the community that chose to remain rather than to return. And the other most obvious point about Esther is that she was obviously very beautiful. And one aspect, though, that we might consider is that beauty has two forms, the external beauty and the internal beauty. And it seems to me that the initial part of the book, the only character trait that we really see in Esther is hear about in Esther is that of her external beauty. And it was that particular beauty that got her the queenship. But it wasn't until later on into the story that once she cast her cares upon God, that we then begin to see an internal beauty in a selfless and a focused woman choosing to risk her own life for the sake of her people. So we know that Esther's Jewish name was Hadassah, and we know in all likelihood that it also means myrtle. And the myrtle tree was a tree that was native to Babylonia. But many of the returning exiles, they used to take that myrtle tree with them upon their return to the land. And as a result, this tree became sort of a symbol for the nation of Israel as being transplanted from Babylon back into their homeland, into Palestine. Now, Zechariah, you will remember, used the myrtle tree as a symbol of Israel in Zechariah chapter 1, verses 7 to 11. And that was during the time when the people were also returning to their land. So that symbolism would have been very familiar to them. Many scholars of this book have recognized Esther as a symbol of the Jewish people living among the Gentiles. And Esther's parents probably named her after this beautiful tree, as the picture, I think, shows, if you can see it. The myrtle, in fact, is quite an attractive shrub. It has evergreen leaves, and under optimum conditions, it grows to over 24 feet high. It's the fragrant small white flowers. They're produced in the middle of summer. The fruit on them is small, sort of a black berry that resembles a blueberry in size. And it's edible, but it's not very often eaten. The entire plant contains a fragrant oil. And we also know that Esther was her Persian name, and that name means star. One view about her Persian name is that she was given this name in honor of Ishtar, which was a pagan goddess, very familiar to the Persians. But another suggestion is that the myrtle tree itself bears a beautiful star-like flower. And Esther may have received her Persian name because she was like the flower of the myrtle tree, full of beauty and grace. In life, she became just that, the flower of Israel. She was not just physically beautiful, but through faith, she became a great blessing to her people and a great blessing to the Gentiles as well. So with all of that kind of backdrop, we thought that we would spend the remaining time we have this evening on an overview of this book. And I think there's a number of ways you can do an overview. Obviously, you can go through a themes, or you can have a title for every chapter. But this was an interesting sort of approach that I saw in one of the materials I was looking at. It called the chiastic approach in looking at the book. Now, chiastic is kind of a symmetry that you'll find in different literature. And there was a suggestion that the book of Esther, it's 10 chapters long. The first is the opening, the ending is the prologue, or the epilogue, I mean. Opening is prologue, ending is epilogue. There are a chapter each, and then in between you can start to divide it, and it's building. I didn't make a mistake on the where I was aligning the text there. I was supposed to be kind of getting building up. The top is as the least in the frame, the opening background, building up to the king's first decree in chapters 2 and 3, where Haman is set in charge and makes these decrees against the Jewish people, building up to 4 and 5. So that's the first half of the book. Then the second five chapters follow. But right in the very middle, if you were to draw the line, the biggest font in the middle there, chapter 6, verse 1, would draw a line right through the middle of the book, right dab in the middle, would be the turning point of this, if we follow this chiastic approach, where they suggested that it was on the night that the king could not sleep, that the events turned around now and started favoring, and events started taking place to bring God's purpose about saving his people. And so we thought that we would just sort of put this up as something to consider. I've never really been good at looking at literature in different ways, but it was just something of interest that we saw, something that we can think about, the balance there between the first decree in the top in 2 and 3, the second decree in down at the bottom in 8 and 9, I thought it was kind of an interesting way of thinking about the structure, anyways, of this book of Esther. So, one more aspect of this book for us to consider, is quite obvious, it jumps out at us as we go through it, are the frequent parallels that we find between the account of Joseph's life and of Esther. And also of Mordecai, as in the story. The similarities come both by way of style, as in the way of the text, if you go through the text, the way the text's written and the wording of some of the phrases, and also in content itself. And many of the expressions and structures which are absent from other parts of the book, we find in these two accounts, both in Joseph and in Esther. Even their life stories, if we think about it, they're amazingly similar. They bear an amazing resemblance. So we thought we'd just spend a minute taking a look at a few of these. And again, we just put four up as a sample for us to consider. And there's a lot more, and encourage us to take the time and to try and see how many we can actually come up with. What I want us to do is to just keep our hands in Esther, and we'll flip back to Genesis, and we'll look at the related passages for the similarities in style. So while we're in Esther, let's look at Esther chapter 3 and verse 4. And this is when Haman had been elevated to his position of power. Everyone was reverencing and bowing down to him. And in verse 4, the king's servants were concerned that Mordecai himself wasn't doing that. And in Esther 3 verse 4 it says, "Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew." So if we look at that, and then we flip back to Genesis chapter 39, compare the passage there. Genesis 39, verse 10. And this is the account when Potiphar's wife was after Joseph. And in verse 10, it says, "It came to pass, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her to lie by her and to be with her." So in the original, the words that we would focus on here that are very similar between the two are day by day, and that he hearkened not unto her. Those particular passages are almost identical. So while we're in Genesis, let's go to Genesis 41 and look at verses 42 and 43. And this is where Pharaoh, it says in verse 42, "Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand, and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen, and put a gold chain about his neck. And made him to ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried before him, 'Bow the knee,' and he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt." Okay, so that's the account in Genesis 41. Moving over to Esther chapter 8, and we'll only do these two in essence of time. This is kind of the idea of these similarities, though. Esther chapter 8, and actually there's in a number of spots, but if we look at verse 2, again, the king took off his ring, and in other versions it says the exact same language, took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and he gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And down in verse 15, it tells us that Mordecai went out from the presence, again, in the royal apparel, and that's what Joseph himself was arrayed in back in Genesis. So the number of similarities, and the one of the ones that I was also interested in was, I think, the one in Genesis 43. I'll just read that. Where Jacob was needed to send Benjamin back with him to the land in order to demonstrate that they were telling the truth. He finally, in essence of saving his family, he decides to do that. He tells him to take double the money and so on. He says, peradventure, he says, "If I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." So after he sends them away, he says, "If I am bereaved, I am bereaved." And we compare that with Esther's comments in chapter 4 and verse 16, where she decides finally that she's going to represent the people. She's going to make an attempt to go to the king. Similar sort of circumstance, she decides to sacrifice herself, to put her wishes secondary. And she says, if I perish, I perish. So in this one, he says, if I am bereaved, I am bereaved. Here she says, if I perish, I perish. So it's very similar in the style of the language being used. So enough of that. I have handouts, by the way, if you're interested afterwards. I've got all the slides in a smaller format that you can use for note taking if you miss some of those references and if you're interested. So the previous slide was looking at some of the similarities in the style, and we'll just briefly look at some of the similarities in content as well. We know that both stories take place in a foreign country. We know in Egypt under Pharaoh was Joseph's case, and in Esther she was under the Persian influence. And both of them really start out their journey or their path to the elevated positions they were in against their will. Joseph, remember, being sold by his brothers, thrown into jail, forgotten. Esther, I mean, being an orphan, being taken against her will to be judged as a potential queen. They also had rather dramatic circumstances that eventually led them to being in a position of power. And in fact, Mordecai, in this case, was eventually being given many powers over the land, much like Joseph had those similar powers. And there's many other kinds of similarities, and encourage each of us to continue to pursue these kinds of things as we study God's word. So as we bring our time to a conclusion tonight, we want to kind of highlight some of the two of the key passages. One from the words of Joseph when he said, "So now it was not you that sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and Lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." And then it was Mordecai who, in similar style, said to Esther, "For if you remain silent at this time, then relief and deliverance shall come to the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house shall perish. And who knows whether you have not come to royal estate for such a time as this." And so we see again in the parallelism of these two stories, and as we go through the entire book of Esther, that the events taking place are meant to show us the providence of God and to teach us that God's always in control and is always working out his wonderful plan and purpose for us.